My name is Mark Arlepage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each and every week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This is episode 367 with Jeffrey Sullivan, architecture, development, and New York City's first all-electric tower. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, FreshBooks, the cloud-based accounting software that makes running your small firm easy, fast, and secure. Spend less time on accounting and more time doing the work you love. Gusto, the easy online payroll and benefit service built for modern small businesses like ours. In other words, it's a people platform. And RCAT, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM specifications, and so much more, all for free. Thanks to FreshBooks and Gusto and RCAT for supporting Entree Architect and the Entree Architect community of small firm architects. Jeffrey Sullivan, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Mark, thank you for having me.
Jeffrey Sullivan is the studio director at Alloy Development, an architecture development firm based in Dumbo, Brooklyn. He joined Alloy in 2013, starting as a project manager, is currently overseeing the architecture team on two major projects by Alloy, including Dumbo's last factory to loft conversion at 168 Plymouth, as well as a larger block redevelopment at 100 Flatbush, which will present the city's first passive house schools, as well as a 40-story all-electric tower. I want to definitely get into both of those. Alloy is the recipient of numerous awards, and the firm's work has been included in both print and online publications, including the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Architectural Digest Pro, Wallpaper, Fast Company, and more. And so they're doing some really, really interesting work. So I invited Jeffrey to come on here and talk about Alloy and the things they're doing. So Jeffrey, I shared a little bit about you. Let's learn more about you. Let's share your origin story. When did you discover your passion for architecture? What inspired you to become an architect? And how did you get to where you are today?
So that varies a little bit from where we are now. So I grew up in Central Ohio. My parents had a construction company as I was growing up. It was out of our garage. We were, you know, kids answering the phone to help keep the business going, kind of thing.
So, son of an entrepreneur.
Exactly. So it was a fun thing to witness growing up and be a part of, visit job sites, et cetera. And so there was a love for construction from very early on. And so as I grew and matured and, you know, learned more in education, et cetera, I quickly realized that I wanted to become an architect. And so to do that, I found Washington University in St. Louis for a graduate program. And what I really loved about it was it had a both an architecture and a construction management master's degree. So I went there and had a master's in both of those and came out just looking for where I could go next.
Did you do the architecture and the construction management degrees simultaneously?
Correct. So they were, I had a master's Bachelor of Fine Arts in undergrad. And then for graduate school, did both of those together at the same time. Great. And then one of my professors along the way was Jared Delavalle, who is the founder of Alloy, and kind of started to introduce me to this development and architecture combination that we can get into a little bit about Alloy itself. And so after I graduated in 2010, being a person from the Midwest, I was very excited to kind of move to a big city. 2008 was obviously not easy for a lot of people, especially architects.
Rough year.
Yeah. And so New York City was something I wanted to strive to do. And so I made my way out to New York and interned actually briefly for Jared at his office just for a couple months till I could kind of get my feet wet. And then found myself at a small office in Chinatown doing residential architecture and design build there a little bit. And then a couple years later, back in 2013, Jared called me and said, hey, we have a great project coming up. Would love to have you as part of the team, and joined the office ever since.
So you've been there for 7 or 8 years or so?
Correct. Yep.
And what's your position now?
So I came in as a project manager for our One John Street project, as you mentioned. And it kind of, we were a smaller office at the time. We were probably six people or so. And over the years, as we've grown as an office, now become essentially the studio director. I can get into a little bit of the structure of Alloy, but essentially we are fairly diverse within our office, from everything from people who have brokerage backgrounds to design to development. And I would say 90% of our office in of itself has an architecture background, which probably makes us unique and very architecturally focused.
Yeah, let's dive into Alloy as a firm before we jump into any of the projects. Can you sort of share the origin story of Alloy and how it became, and then sort of explain that structure? Because it's a very unique firm.
Yeah. So the origin story itself, it was started in 2006. Jared Della Valle and Catherine and AJ Pyres started it. And the kind of concept behind it was, as any architect deals with both clients and construction, et cetera, they really wanted to take ownership over the process and realize that there was no matter how much you wanted to have your vision in a project, if you are the architect and someone else is the client, you're always a little bit at the mercy of that. And so by taking this ownership, it gives you opportunities to then start to control the narrative and start to create your own trajectory and, really be able to put the values of the architect into the project, which I think really was exciting for everyone involved in the process. So that was in 2006, and a handful of projects we did that were on over by the High Line. And then we started to make our way towards actually where our office is in Dumbo, which is in Brooklyn. We have since done now, I would say 5 of our last 5 projects have been in Dumbo area. So everything's within literally walking distance, a block from our office one direction, block the other direction. The partners live each in our projects that we've done. They walk to the office every morning. So it's evolved to something that's very personal to us, being in Brooklyn and of Brooklyn. It's really become part of our identity.
Yeah. So the two major projects that are in development now, 168 Plymouth and 100 Flatbush, both in Dumbo, right?
Yep. Well, sorry. 168 Plymouth is in Dumbo. They're both in Brooklyn. 168 Plymouth is immediately adjacent to our current office. And it's a really interesting project. The 100 Flatbush is just in downtown Brooklyn, all less than a mile from our office as well. 168 Plymouth has been a really interesting, opportunity for us, because it's, while we have a lot of experience in Dumbo dealing with traditional warehouse buildings that get converted, this is probably one of the last loft conversions in the neighborhood. It's a historical district. And so there's not a lot of opportunity left for buildings like this. And so we were really excited to have this opportunity. We've been having our eye on it for a while. It's a really beautiful combination of buildings. They were part of the Masry paint work. So they, from 100 years ago, essentially did paint production here in these different building typologies. So it's combining a wooden masonry construction with factory daylight concrete construction, which was a challenge in and of itself, on top of putting 2 additions on top of each one of those.
Can you explain a little bit about Dumbo and the history of Dumbo? And because you're talking about how these buildings are being converted, what was Dumbo prior? Also, for anybody who doesn't know, can you explain what Dumbo means?
Sure.
It's an acronym.
Yeah. So Dumbo itself is an acronym for Down Under Manhattan Bridge Overpass. So we are on the northern edge of Brooklyn at the water at the East River, looking across at Manhattan. It's a little disorienting because the river turns in a funny way there. But we are where Brooklyn Bridge and Manhattan Bridge essentially dump right into Brooklyn. So it's a very unique location. You know, for a long time, it was shipping and a very much a port area, butts up to an area called Fulton's Landing, and the other direction is a Vinegar Hill. And so it's really has a really rich history to it. In the last, I would say, 20 years, it's changed pretty significantly. It was it took a while till people really noticed that actually being looking at Manhattan is one of the best things you can be doing. And so when you kind of just step back from the city a little bit, you get this unbelievable view of Manhattan. And on top of that, there's an amazing history of the building stock and structures in the area.
Lots of industrial warehouse type of buildings, right?
Yeah, a lot of industrial warehouse, you know, some vacant lots that have become popped up to be new buildings, like our one John Street, which is on the waterfront that we completed now 5 years ago. But yeah, so it's a old industrial building. And yeah, a lot of the offices have started to fill the locations, et cetera, in these areas and residential condos. The streets are old cobblestone streets that are still in existence and getting repaired. And it's a really beautiful area.
Yeah, it dates back to the colonial era. It was part of the colonial port of Manhattan. It wasn't the Manhattan port, it was the Brooklyn port. But it was that same area. So you have history from the 18th century all the way up through today in that area.
Yeah, and I think it's part of the architectural challenges we find too. As you can imagine, when you are renovating a building that's 100, 120 years old, there's all sorts of discoveries and gems through the process of what you, how you adjust and tweak, and how you either bring out the qualities of it or you address them in various ways, which is all part of the excitement in the process.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about 100 Flatbush, because that's very unique. You're talking about passive house schools and a 40-story all-electric tower. And so let's talk about that project. How did that project come about? And talk about the program of that project.
Sure. Yeah, the project itself is has a bit of history as well. You know, we probably 5 years ago, we started assembling parts of the block. It's a very strange block in the sense it's more trapezoidal, and it is cut by Flatbush Avenue, which is a pretty big thoroughfare through downtown Brooklyn, proper downtown Brooklyn. There's the Barclays Center across the street. There's Williamsburg Savings Bank, one of the more historic towers built in Brooklyn. And so we found this very kind of acutely angled site of probably six lots that we started acquiring through in 2015. We were approached through a request for expression of interest from the Educational Construction Fund. They're a state agency that essentially leverages city-owned assets to build new schools. And so one of the sites on the block was or is an existing school, the Cahil Gibran International Academy. It's a dual language, Arabic, English speaking public school. And their facilities are in buildings that are from 1860, 1890, et cetera. And they are, while they're beautiful, they are not proper school, modern day schools. They don't have accessibility. They don't have a gym. They don't have assembly spaces. And so they said, hey, let's work together to upzone the site by increasing the floor area ratio. We can now use this additional square footage to essentially build and pay for two new schools for the city. The city is starved now more than ever for locations, safe and proper locations for students to learn. And so working with them through a lengthy, what they refer to as ULERP process, with the city and the community boards, you know, we probably took on a 2 to 3 year process of, 100 plus meetings with community members, stakeholders involved within the local community, the city themselves, to essentially rezone an entire city block. So we've now gone through the rezoning process. We finished probably 2 years ago. The site now is capable of holding up to about 1 million square feet. What's very unique about it is it's a two-phase process. So the existing school has to remain in operation. We're building a new school, a new tower first. And then once complete, the students move over, and then we can build our second phase. And so that's kind of the entitlement summary of how we landed where we did. The architecture and kind of aspirational part that we got into was what came next. And so for the school itself, we're not the designers of it. We're developing it with the Educational Construction Fund. Architecture Research Office is the are the designers for the project. And in conversation with them, the city, the School Construction Authority, who actually manages schools in New York City once they're in operation, the public schools, we were talking with them on how we can really push the envelope on what a new school means. And I think ourselves and the city got really excited about the possibility of a passive house school. They have ambition for, they're owning these for 100 years or however long, these buildings. And so for them, the idea of having a school that is, low energy use long term, can maintain itself, is exactly what, a modern school should be. So that sort of set the standard and something that we've been pushing through over the past year or so with our sustainability consultant, Thorne Tomasetti, to really do the modeling and get through that process, which has been an interesting process in and of itself.
We will return to our conversation after this quick break to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect, FreshBooks, Gusto, and RCAT. There's a lot to love about being an entrepreneur architect, but trying to figure out our financials on our own? No, it's not one of them. Luckily, there's FreshBooks, the all-in-one accounting solution that's built for businesses like ours. FreshBooks takes all the not-so-fun parts of running a business, from building and tracking invoices to organizing expenses to managing online payments, takes all of that and automates it and simplifies it, saving you up to 11 hours a week in the process. FreshBooks has your back at tax time too. With a ton of reports to choose from, you'll know exactly where your business stands, and you can easily hand the keys off to your accountant so they can take over when it's time to reconcile everything for the year. So try FreshBooks for free for 30 days. No credit card required. Go to freshbooks.com/architect and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section so they know that you came from Entree Architect. That's freshbooks.com/architect and let them know that you're a member of the Entree Architect community. Running an architecture business is hard. Endless to-do lists, employees to take care of, and your ever-present bottom line. So first of all, kudos to you for staying on top of all of it. And as a listener of the Entree Architect podcast, by now you already know about our friends at Gusto. Gusto built an easier and more affordable way to manage payroll, benefits, and more. They help over 100,000 businesses with tasks like automated payroll tax filing, simple direct deposits, free health insurance administration, 401ks, onboarding tools. You name it, Gusto made it easy. And they really care about the small business owners they work with. Their support team is attentive and helpful. And since money can be tight right now, you'll even get 3 months free once you run your first payroll. Just go to gusto.com/architect and start setting up your business today. and you'll see what I mean when I say easy. Again, that's 3 months of free payroll at gusto.com/architect. You're going to love Gusto. Get started today at gusto.com/architect. We are well underway here in 2021, and still, no word from most trade shows. We can't wait around for news on which event is proceeding, which is postponed again, and which are canceled. We still need our continuing education credits. And let's not wait until December like we did last year. Let's start planning right now. How are we going to get our 2021 continuing education credits? Our friends at RCAT can help. Along with manufacturer product information, specifications, CAD, and BIM, all free by the way, RCAT also provides a list of over 150 manufacturers with accredited continuing education courses. Start earning those credits today at rcat.com/CES. It's another free resource RCAT provides to make your life easier. Free continuing education credits. Available now at rcat.com/CES. That's rcat.com/CES. FreshBooks, Gusto, and RCAT. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. Jeff, can you just really quickly explain what Passive House is? Most of our audiences are architects and know what Passive House is, but anybody who's listening who doesn't understand what Passive House is may have a very different idea of what Passive House school means.
Sure. And I can't pretend to have all the knowledge on it, but essentially where depending on Passive House is driven by the energy use more so than some of the other components like lead might drive something. And so the goal is essentially the energy use, I believe, per square foot is below a particular EUI. And so there's two types of Passive House too. So there's a Passive House US and a Passive House International. We're working with Passive House International, which I think was the original kind of standard. And so what they do, it requires a lot of back and forth with them, but essentially they will go through every single detail and every single nook and cranny of your modeling to make sure you have a very sealed building and then that your actual systems themselves can be dialed back as small as possible to minimize the amount of energy usage that you ultimately end up expanding on the building.
So super insulation, super hyper efficient, very low resource use. Imagine a super economical, sustainable building. That's the intent of a Passive House project.
Yeah, extremely high performing windows, 2 foot thick walls on the exterior. The vapor barrier is running below grade and below the slab. You're essentially encapsulating the entire building in every single way you can review the penetrations, thermal bridging. So it's even at the lot lines, there's methods of how you shift the vapor barrier from the exterior to the inside face just to maintain continuity in areas you otherwise wouldn't have access to. So it's a very thorough process to create a high performing building.
Yeah. Is that rare for a school, especially New York City school? Is it rare? It's probably the first and only at this point, right?
It is the first in New York City. There've been other aspirations in New York, which are great. I don't know. I'm sure there probably is someone somewhere, but I think we're pushing the first in the city, which we're really excited about.
It's because it's much more expensive, correct?
Short
term.
Yeah, so I think you're definitely more than a standard building. You're looking at an expense for the materials themselves. There's no lying that a thicker wall that's 2 feet thick is probably more expensive than a 1 foot thick one. But I think the long term payback in operational costs and things like that. I think it's the right thing to do, candidly, when you have the opportunity.
Yeah, and long term, it will save lots of energy and lots of money, and it's the right thing to do.
Exactly. And the And so I think with that, the tower, which we are both the architects and the developers on, we kind of stumbled into an opportunity that we were really excited about, which was essentially to do the first all-electric tower in Brooklyn. We were working on the project and ran up against a little bit of a roadblock when the local utility company was suggesting they were putting a moratorium on gas to buildings because they were essentially trying to push a larger pipeline through for approval. And so we said to ourselves, you know, we've always, you know, especially with the climate change and everything going on, that the carbon impact is something that we all take very seriously as architects and in our decisions. And so internally and with our consultants, we said, you know, how hard is it actually to say, you know what, we don't need your gas. We're going to go, how do we go all electric? Right. You know, the Tesla of towers in a way. And like, and so we were started researching everything we had to do, systems of change. And at the end of the day, it was not as complex as one would think. You know, the base building systems, the boilers, things like that, you know, would go to an electric resistance system. They are getting better and better every day. And so that was probably the biggest hurdle for us. And then, you know, then from there, it was just a trickle down to the other systems and making sure that those all met. So, you know, cooktops in the residential side of things, the offices, you know, they are more than willing to kind of cooperate with that using VRF systems and all sorts of things. So it was an amazing kind of push, and to see how once you shift the systems that direction, it actually started to open up also new opportunities for, oh, I don't have to vent this boiler to the roof anymore. Right. And now, you know, now that it's electric. So
yeah. And I would imagine there's probably additional square feet, right? A square footage that comes along with that. Then no longer do you need chases for all those pipes and things like that and stacks.
Yeah. So as both a developer and an architect, you're looking at every opportunity you can. And so it did start to open up these new opportunities, both spatially and otherwise. And I would say one thing that's very specific to New York City as well was the local law 97 is one that passed recently, which essentially is a carbon tax. And so similar to that, we were looking to utilize that as a tool to essentially help ourselves, not just like internally justify and otherwise, that like, hey, you know, this is the world we're in. This is the direction New York City's going, the state's going, country's going. Like, we need to be in the forefront of this. And so I think with both the school and the tower, and then starting, you know, whatever, 13 years ago, you know, at smaller condo projects, seeing the evolution to something that's more forward thinking got us really, really excited. And the last, just because it's a whole block, we've been working with the USGBC and our sustainability consultants for a new program called LEED for Communities. And so what's really great about that is I think it's they're identifying that, you know, while a typical LEED is addressing a building and its performance, that as you tie into your communities, there's more and more there that you're impacting in ideally a positive way. And so we've been really excited to work with them both for these two components, our phase two component to help identify what aspirations our second phase will have that will help benefit the community and you know, create more affordable housing, more, you know, areas for people to work, schools, et cetera.
Before we wrap things up, Jeffrey, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the firm and how it's structured, because it's a unique structure. You're both architects and developers. How does that work? And sort of, you know, strategically, what does the firm look like in terms of your staff and how it's structured? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, of course. So the office itself is an open floor plan. We're 16 people. We're relatively, you know, medium to small size office. We are, of the 16, I would say 12 are architecture background. We probably have 8 licensed architects. It was founded on like architecture principles in a way. We're all very design focused, et cetera. We have, I would say, a very interdisciplinary background between people. So while I have a construction and architecture background, there are people who have development backgrounds, people who are licensed brokers in architecture backgrounds, with people who do branding and marketing and design and architecture backgrounds. And so with that kind of open floor plan development, we have a very level playing field where we rely on each other to provide feedback, to find opportunities that you wouldn't expect. And so from an office perspective, when we have a project, we only do one or two projects at a time. We like that because it allows us to focus intently on what we're doing. And given that we're not, if architecture is, SD to, CD, CA, development is acquisitions, which could take however long beforehand, to sales and turnover and life after building, if you happen to own the building long-term. And so the two-year kind of window really becomes a 5, 6, 7 year window. And so for us, we're always focusing on these different parts. And so as an office, it's, as I mentioned, it's very open. It's a very studio-based culture. When we're designing, it's, people are shredding, they're pinning up on the board, where the interns, the partners, everyone in between are sitting in the room arguing why they like this thing or that thing. We joke with each other, best design wins. Like, doesn't matter who came up with it. And so there's a really architectural studio based culture to it, which is maybe counterintuitive to what people might think in a development office. I think our goal and what we aspire to and what we like is that we're in a lot of ways redefining values. We try to look at something and say, how valuable is this thing? If the money's coming out of your pocket, is it worth spending this money on? Because then you really truly start to question the value of that thing. And so I think similarly from a development lens, we do recognize, while someone might say, well, that doesn't underwrite to give me the most return possible. But as an architect, you say, no, like this, trust, this is worth it. Like the architect in you is like, no, you gotta go for this. Like other people aren't doing this. And so there's that architectural, aspiration within the development side of things within the office. And so we have those conversations where literally all sitting next to each other saying, well, that didn't, I don't know how we're going to afford this or that, or someone would say, look how beautiful this is. And I think with the discussions, there's a high efficiency too, where you're not prepping for a client presentation. You're putting a sketch or putting up a digital model, spinning around and saying, oh, I was trying to achieve this. And like, oh yeah, I get it. Because we're all coming from a similar background.
I can imagine that it's very integrated and that collaborative, that typically where the development team and the architecture team are in two separate buildings, two separate companies doing their own thing, and they all have their own priorities. Whereas when you have everybody in one room, one big open room, that process starts to feed off of one another. The architects start to understand more about what the priorities of the development side is, and the development side starts to understand more about the value of the design and the architecture that can come from providing good quality design. Is that happening?
Yeah, and I think you hit exactly on the head. That overhearing, that sense of you're digesting all the information through the day. We intentionally have calls where people will be walking by and they'll poke their head in and be like, actually, I saw this, or this moment makes a lot of sense and be really nice here. And so there's this feedback and collaboration that we might say, we may pull someone in from our brokerage team and say, how would you what's the demographic? Who would you sell this to? And how would this go? And so, and then someone from our marketing team might also come in and have a cool sketch or some idea that they just came up with. So there's a very open, free flow within the office. That's always a great energy to have happening all the time around the projects, which is always really exciting.
If you could share one thing that a small firm architect could do today to build a better business for tomorrow, what would you say?
I think selfishly from our own office, I think diversifying your own interests and background is really valuable. I think as we've seen, there's people within our office have these varying backgrounds that I think helps you engage with the community in different ways, whether it is through construction or through design or through just meeting people on the streets. But I think it has a lot of value in the success of a company.
His name is Jeffrey Sullivan. The company is Alloy Architecture and Development. You can learn more about Alloy at alloyllc.com. We'll have a link to that on the show notes. Jeffrey, this has been a really interesting conversation. I'm a New York guy who just moved to North Carolina about a year ago, and so I miss my city. I didn't live in the city. I lived outside the city, but I have a little part of my heart there. And so it's nice to hear what's happening there and to sort of understand what's happening over in Brooklyn. So thanks for sharing that story, the projects that you're working on. And Alloy is a fascinating firm. So thanks for sharing your knowledge here at Entree Architect Podcast.
Of course. Thank you, Mark. This has been really great.
You have been listening to episode 367 of the Entree Architect Podcast with Jeffrey Sullivan of Alloy Architecture and Development. If you'd like to access the show notes or share this episode with a friend, the link is entrearchitect.com/episode367. That's entrearchitect.com/episode367. I know I ask you every week to share that link, but I would really love it if you could, because that's the way this podcast grows, so more architects learn about what we're doing. So share entrearchitect.com/episode367 and say, hey, this is a pretty interesting conversation that Mark had with Jeffrey. I think you should listen. entrearchitect.com/episode367. Entree Architect is proud to be a partner with the largest, most engaged AEC multimedia network on the planet, Gable Media. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. Go check that out, gablemedia.com, gablemedia.com. And today is the final day to purchase the Entree Architect P2P Profit course. It's the on-demand video course that teaches the financial management system developed specifically for you, for architects, and the unique way that we work. You'll learn how to plan for profit, how to track your progress, and how to make the adjustments necessary for financial success year after year. We will walk you through everything, chart of accounts, the profit loss statement, the balance sheet. We'll give you key financial performance indicators. The entire system is there. Enrollment is still open, but tonight is the last night. It will close tonight, Friday, March 19th, 2021 at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. That's midnight tonight. Friday, March 19th, 2021. Visit entrearchitect.com/profit course to enroll. Be well, my friends. Be healthy, happy, safe, and secure. Thank you for listening today. Love, learn, and share what you know.